When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
This is One Hate Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take it out.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and joining me for the 144th minute is a friend of the show and a man who gives unbelievably great Twitter. He is an author, most notably for Peckerwood, which is available all over the place. You can buy it on Kindle in Oz if you can't get a physical paperback, otherwise it's on Amazon. But we've just been discussing off air that his novel Fierce Bitches, which is actually published in Australia, is now out of print everywhere except France. So if you can read French, like my friend Seamus at work, you should buy yourself a copy and get on that. He is Jedediah Ayres. He is a top shelf man aficionado. Jedediah, welcome back to One Heat Minute.
Thanks for having me. You know, it occurs to me, if you're in Australia, you could probably find Fierce Bitches in a used or Goodwill shop or something like that. So
yeah, there you go. maybe secondhand bookstore aficionados as well out there, that people who just know how to find this sort of stuff, get on that. You might be able to find it. So here we are, my friend.
I'll get almost as much royalties that way.
So here we are. Jedediah is a great proponent of this show. There are some people that I can call on that have been really supportive to the show and that have been guests on the show and that we've become great friends around the show. And I had a very sort of trying couple of minutes here to fill, because they really are, you know, very contentious, I suppose, and very disturbing, because throughout this movie, you know, we've seen some innocent people, some bystanders be killed. We've seen a prostitute sort of living really hard suffer the wrath of Wayne Grove, another intensely disturbing minute. But the sort of emotional fragility of Natalie Portman's Lauren in only her second cinematic role really comes to a crescendo over the last couple of minutes. But particularly here on 144, we see Vincent post-discovery of Lauren in the tub. So what I might do is quickly play the minute for us now. You guys can listen along and examine and hear Vincent's reaction and hear some of the fallout. And then Jedediah and I will come back and sort of talk about this and everything that is Vincent actually showing Justine and his family what he's good at. Here we go. Let's have a listen.
Day, not you, baby. Not you.
What, where would she be? I mean, her name is Lauren. Lauren Gustafson, and she's supposed to be here with the police. Please. I need some. Leave it.
I got you, baby.
There it is, my friend, from nursing Lauren. In that moment alongside the bathtub and sort of making sure that she's not going to lose blood, to getting to the panic of the hospital and having Justine there. Learning Lauren's surname, Gustafson, a little revelation for people in heat, if people have not been knowing what her surname is for the entire film. And Justine waiting there and Vincent jumping into action. It's a scary little scene.
It is. How old are your kids?
They're
not that age.
No. Much younger, but nonetheless, I'm disturbed. My little girl is 2.5 and my boy is 9 months.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I got two boys that age right now, and yeah, it's hard to watch.
Very hard. Very hard to watch. Especially because she's so because even her barrettes, you know, not having her barrettes throws her into a panic in this film. And so, like, when you see that she's taken those steps, and particularly that she's, like, the way that she's gone at it, cut multiple parts of her body and just tried to exit, it's like that sort of unimaginable grief and sort of disorientation for a young person when your mind is already just mush. Like, I mean, until I was about 25, I was still a high-functioning ape. So, you know, I just can't imagine, you know, when you get caught up like that as a young kid, that sort of, you know, how desolate the world must feel. And she's, it's really sad.
It strikes me looking at the wounds, looking at the cuts and their placement, and she knew what she was doing. And I was thinking about it. It was 1995. This is before the internet was quite what it is now, you know, in every house and everybody's literate and with it. I'm thinking, how does she know at that age? How does she know how to do it? And the only thing that made sense to me is because she's around Vincent. Like, she picks up the stuff that her mom doesn't even pick up. You know, the scene earlier where he picks her up in a car, you know, he does the U-turn in the middle of the street. She's sitting at the bus stop, and she gets in the car and she says, "Hi, Mike," to, who is it, Drucker?
Bosco. Hey, Rory.
Bosco,
hey,
okay.
Ted Levine. Hey, Rory.
Yeah, so she knows more about Vincent's life, it seems, than her mom does. And she's really attached herself to Vincent, and she's picked up all these little details that, you know, he won't share with her mom. You know, he's like, I don't share that stuff with you because it's morbid and useless. But it occurs to me, I don't know, I think she is so desperate for, you know, to fill the void her father's left in her life, that she's latched on to Vincent. She went to his place to do this. She did it very efficiently and, you know, did it the right way. Instead of, there's not like little slash marks all over the place. It's like, no, she knew exactly where to go.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's pretty upsetting.
You hit me with a gut punch there of reading it that way, because it resonates so much that, like, she's picking up the details, she's sort of unobtrusively sitting in the back of cars getting rides with Vincent, and the guys are unintentionally talking shop and they think that she doesn't understand, or, you know, they're using lexicon that she may not get, but she's there like a sponge just picking it up. And
she is.
I mean, even my kids, your boys, surely, like, they're just sponges for, like, for everything. You're like, oh God, I can't say that ever again. I can't say that around them ever again. It's over.
I remember when my kids were in like maybe one of the very first parent-teacher conferences I had, I just asked, like, very timidly, very kind of almost shamefacedly, like, what kinds of things are they saying? What is, because it occurred to me, you know, I'm watching Deadwood right, you know, right by their heads on the other side of this wall, you know, after they go to bed every night. I'm like, are they, what are they saying? And, yeah, that's right. They pick up. They really do.
Cocksucker.
That's right. That's,
just dropping some woo, dropping some woo in that, school.
that's what's coming out at school.
Oh my goodness! Oh my goodness! Yeah, look, it's a really, you know, that there's other readings of Justine in this scene, and there's, you know, probably more. There's some more harsh readings of Justine in the film, as in, you know, a mother who, you know, there's a way that it can be read, and I'll allow it for future episodes to sort of be fleshed out by people who've, you know, so put it better than me. But, you know, there's ways to read it as this is punishment for Justine, and some of the women in this movie get punished for, you know, wanting to live their lives. And so there's definitely readings that can approach it there. But I think I really like refocusing less about what this means to Justine and more about what it is as a child on the peripheral of adults, like seemingly universally adults who are, you're in that weird corridor. It's like you're in this weird blind spot of, I'm not completely a child, I'm self-sufficient enough, but I'm also craving desperately the attention that, you know, my mother wants in her relationship, and in her cravings for attention and some semblance of normality. It's like I'm even further relegated to the sidelines, and then she's looking for a father who's not there, and the only one is, you know, even right at the beginning of the movie, like Vincent's like, no school today. Like, you can tell that he's taking an interest and he likes her, and he's got a little connection with her in this world. And you know, right from the very beginning, you can see that. So it's here that, you know, despite the fact that she's kind of, she may have heard, she may have known exactly what she was going to do, she goes in and does it. There's nowhere else in the world that you'd really rather be than next to Vincent when you've done something like this.
Yeah, and it ends up happening this way. I'm not going to suggest that she's trying to do this, but, you know, looking at Vincent and Justine's relationship, she's constantly, you know, saying, I want you to let me in, to be part of your life. And he's, you know, he says to Neil at one point, or no, I think he says to Justine later, he says, it's just like you're always telling me, I'm only what I'm going after, you know, that's all I am. And,
yes.
And she, Lauren, in doing this, and putting herself in a place where she knows Vincent's the one that's going to discover her, she literally brings her mother into Vincent's work.
Yes. You know,
we've already seen him comforting the dead prostitute's mother, and the scene where, you know, he's holding Justine and doing this, it's like he could, I'm not saying he is on autopilot, but he could be on autopilot here. This is what you say to grieving mothers. This is how you know.
Yeah.
He does this. He's finally brought, or she has finally brought Vincent and her mother together for, you know, their most emotionally honest and open conversation, even after, you know, the whole Ralph debacle. it's their best moment in the film, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. It's because I think it's also like, there's a sort of morbid phrase, but it carries a great deal of truth, which is like, there's nothing like a funeral to bring a family together. And so there's sort of this scare where the stakes of life and death like hit them at home. And it's not about, because what Vincent does comes with inherent risks. It's about it's the blind spot. It's Lauren as a kid and this innocent. And you're right. Like, you know, there's not a more naked place to emotionally entangle with one another than an emergency waiting room when your child is in surgery. You know, like, there's no space that strikes more fear into me and dread than that sort of space. And I think, you know, in an upcoming episode, may you rest in peace, I've already shared it, but we'll be sharing it back again in the sequence of the, in the show, is, you know, the greater editor and, you know, George Romero and Al Pacino, alumni, Pasquale Buber, Pat Buber, his favorite scene of the entire film is Diane Venora and Pacino in that waiting room. And that exact moment that you talked about, you know, all I am is what I'm going after. It's just that it sort of rings with this perfection of, like, and this honesty, that some of their other encounters, because they're in the middle of, you know, well rehearsed in their minds anyway, fights. In this moment, there's none of that artifice. It's just like, here it is. We're in a waiting room. This is awful.
Yeah. And I think this is, you know, we talk about the parallels, the very intentional parallels throughout the film between Neil and Vincent. And, you know, listening to the show, you brought up a lot the similarities, you know, how between Neil and Wengro, how Wengro's like the anti-Neil, or he's what Neil doesn't want to be, but is secretly afraid that he is, and, you know, when he lets himself act emotionally and things like that. But thinking about it in that term, I thought, well, then who's Vincent's Wengro? And I think it's got to be Justine's ex-husband. It's got to be Lauren's father, who's never there. You know, Vincent is constantly, anytime he talks about him, he's saying, you know, does he have any idea what he's doing to this kid? You know, he's constantly flaking out on her. He's not there when she needs him to be. And that's in the end really what he's doing too. He is constantly failing Justine and Lauren by taking off on them. You know, he leaves in the middle of the date night, and he, even in the emergency room, you know, when he says, I'm here for you, I'm not going anywhere, and then his beeper goes off, and he just kind of, I mean, you could almost hear, like, the Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Bum, 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 da-da, da-da, da-da.
Guess I'm out of here, because he's secretly afraid that he is that absent father figure, that absent guy. You know, he's worked his way through marriages before, and I think it's eaten him up, not enough to change him. But it's eaten him up that he's also leaving this, you know, in his wake, this sort of emotionally scarred people who he jettisons when he wants to go to work. And
it's that old that old reflection deflection, right? It's like, you know, does he have any idea? And that's what's so great about when he's like, does he have any idea what he's doing to this kid? And, like, there's a great moment where Justine goes, "What? I don't know." She's like, she's so perplexed and annoyed. Like, what? I don't know. Like, you're doing. Like, she goes as far as to say, "The movie is not as heavy-handed as to go, you're doing the same thing." But him saying it and her reaction of just completely looking perplexed and frustrated, is the exact like, it hits the right pitch. You're just like, oh, that's perfect. That's exactly what she needed to do there. I wanted to throw something by you, because I was talking a lot. I went way back to, you know, one of the opening minutes of the film. I think it'll be the second or third minute of this film. And there's a Neil walking into a Goodwill Hospital. And just as he's entering the doors, before he gets into sort of the bowels of the emergency department and sort of sneaks his way through without touching anything with any fingerprints, there's a statue out the front of Mary, you know the Christian statue with the Mother Mary nursing a sort of a Jesus off of the cross, you know, sort of withered and exhausted. And for the longest time, for the longest time, that pose I always associated with this, with the tenderness of the touch and the foreshadowing of the relationship with Neil and Vincent in the crescendo of the movie. You know, that tenderness of
right.
that withered thing. And I think that's pretty spot on. But just in the minute that we're watching, you know, this, the 144th minute, it's like 24, 25 seconds into the minute. And, or even it might just eclipse in the previous minute and sort of carries through, but it literally has Vincent nursing Lauren in that way. He's nursing a withered Lauren. It's obviously, flipped around. It's inverted from what the statue is, but it's in that moment of like, I don't think I'm fully grasping what the movie's trying to say in that moment. Like having Neil walk past, like Neil's the guy who walks past that moment, and is Vincent the other guy? I'm sure there's plenty of more, you know. I'm sure there's a reading in there, but I'm just struck by some of all throughout this movie of echoes and match cuts, and sort of corresponding experiences that are happening and how they're being portrayed and what the differences and the contrasts are throughout the film. And I just see that and I'm like, you know, this is Vincent and his purpose is the truest, perhaps, is probably the best reading that I can come up with at this minute.
No, that's great. I hadn't thought of that. But, you know, you notice things all the time watching this film.
yes.
I was struck today thinking about, I was watching it again and specifically thinking about Vincent and Justine and Lauren and what's going on with them, because the minute we're talking about it, and I'm watching it, and all the scenes shot in, you know, Justine's ex-husband's dead tech post-modernistic bullshit house, you know, it's his house. It's the ex-husband's house, and he's not there. And all the, like, the little, I was just looking at the decorations and things like that, and there's little bits of art on the wall, and there's a couple of paintings that could be child's paintings of just sort of a blank face, completely featureless masculine face, I'm guessing. And then there's a, right next to it is a just a little kitschy decoration. It might be a magnet, it might be a woodcut or something like that, of just like an empty man's suit. And when Neil or Vincent is talking to Ralph and he's sitting on that couch, there's a painting behind him of, it looks like maybe there's it's a man wearing a button-up shirt with his sleeves rolled up, and he's kind of leaning on a desk thinking about something hard, but the face is completely gone, and all you can really make out is just this sort of empty male figure without a face. And it's just stuff that's all over the house. The house is just haunted by absent men, and that was just striking me today again, it's not something that I noticed for however many times I watched the movie, but the level of placing that kind of thing in there but not hitting you over the head with it is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I think it's so that's the thing that strikes you on rewatches of just any movie, you know, to dress a set and to take that much care with perhaps providing that haunting and then just to blow past it, because they're big performances, you know, they're full frames, you know, they're big performances. They're challenging one another. It doesn't do long languid holds of, you know, the paintings as if to sort of punctuate and underscore a particular point. Like you said, it's just blowing past this stuff. And it's like on rewatch, you're like, this is a space that is haunted. Like, this is a space that's haunted by a previous relationship. You know, Vincent has no possessions, according to this. You know, a pearl-handled gun and a television. Like, that's all he's got. It's all he's got. And a collection of oversized suits. Like, that's all that this guy has in his entire life. That's his entire repertoire. Everything else is elsewhere. So it's even more sort of devastating there. And you also wonder, and I think you brought up the best point, like haunted by absent men. It's like, Vincent, this is Vincent's third marriage. Does he not have any children?
Yeah.
And that's like a, if we assume that Vincent has no children, it's like, wow. Like he, I mean, I maybe get it with one marriage that you don't have kids, but three and no kids. And you're like, yeah, this guy was functioning on a level of dedication and finding these women that were totally okay not to have kids like consecutively, or got to a point where like, no, we need to settle down and actually have a family. Nope, not going to work. That's not who I am.
Yeah.
I'm going to be that. Yeah. I'm going to be the empty suit. I'm going to be the blank face. I'm just going to be the decorations on the former house, and that's all I got. That's all I am.
Well, one thing that comes up a lot in Michael Mann movies, it comes up in Thief and Jericho Mile, and I always read it into Heat, is the thing about, you know, men who've been in prison, and they've got the little those collage posters they make and keep in their wallet of, you know, the life they want to make for themselves when they get out. And, in Thief, when James Caan's talking to Tuesday Weld, and, you know, he shows her the poster and basically points at the family, you know, he's like, that's you, you know, pointing at the woman, and there's children in it, and she's like, who are they? And he's like, well, they come later, you know, and he goes out and gets a kid. He goes out and gets a woman, you know, and the way he goes and gets her is very much, it's very similar, I think, to the way Neil and Edie have their relationship. It is very 0-60, you know, in the blink of an eye, because he's serious. He feels she's serious, and, you know, the James Caan line, you know, is like, let's get this big romance going. You know, he's frustrated. She won't just jump into it with him, and, you know, Neil wants Edie to take off with him. Well, I think it's, you know, very much possibly the same thing with Vincent. He knows his real calling, his real thing that he's going to do with his life is be a hunter out on the street. But he's got three wives. Maybe it's because they are just sort of that thing that you ought to do. You ought to have a home life. But you ought to have a home life and keep a hotel room all the time. I mean, he's already had this hotel room, clearly, if Lauren knows where it is and can get into it,
yes.
Clearly... That's his space. That's what he holds back from the marriage. He's always got this hotel room that he can go to. You know, I mean, does he go to it because he doesn't want to come in at all hours and disturb the household when he, you know, needs to get some sleep during the day or something like that? I don't know. But it's always there. He's had this, and it's common knowledge. And, you know, so that makes me think he's not, like, screwing around on Justine or something, but... the fact that her daughter knows where it is, but he's got it. He's holding that part back.
Yes.
He's never letting go of it. He's never fully invested in the marriage. It's just like, yeah, you ought to get married. You ought to have a home life, but, you know, it's not going to last probably like the others haven't lasted. And,
So pivoting now to, like, you know, this gives Vincent, a key contrast too, in that, you know, someone who is deeply close to him, with Neil, it's been his crew, and picking Chris Chehalis up by the scruff, dragging him to, you know, DIY Jeremy Piven surgery, and now Vincent sort of protecting Lauren here, taking her to a hospital. It's like, it gives Vincent, you know, another moment. Gives Vincent another moment of, like, reinforcing who this guy is. It's like, what keeps him awake at night, what haunts him. and another one of those people, you know, refusing to allow Lauren to be one of those people who's haunting him in his dreams and nightmares every night, you know, sitting at that table, because he found them, and he races into the hospital and he's there and he's already at least been fast enough to get people on the horn, get Lauren's mum Justine down to the hospital, know exactly where to drive into the emergency room, and then, you know, just at the, you know, the beginnings of the moment there were the ending of this moment and the following of the preceding the following moment coming up is, you know, we watch Vincent sort of get into work mode completely.
Yep. He springs right to it. He's probably been in this situation many times. That's the impression he gives anyway. He knows all the directions later on, you know, just seconds after our minute ends to tell all the doctors, you know, I need this kind of surgeon and that one. They even ask if she's on drugs, and he says no, very confidently, and which kind of surprised me. I'm like, really? Is that supposed to be a blind spot? Has he, like, done a drug test? Did he suspect she was going to commit suicide? Apparently not, but he's confident she's not on drugs, so... He's taking care of business all the time.
Yeah.
So I got a question for you.
Yes.
About, so obviously this, you know, LA takedown is made first. Supposedly Mann already had written the script for Heat, the whole long script, and then, you know, made LA takedown by excising large bits of it. This part is excised from LA Takedown. This is not part of the LA Takedown story. In fact, Vincent Hanna is not with anyone in that movie. But my question to you is he 100% right all the time in the places that it differs from LA Takedown? Do you prefer anything about LA Takedown? Do you think this is adding a lot to Heat, or do you think LA Takedown, you know, the way it, there's no fat on that movie. It just moves.
Yeah, it's a million miles an hour. The thing that, so it's a weird thing, right? So it's hard for me to say Jedediah because I've watched this movie so many times and especially unpacking this, I relish all of this. Like, I need this for Vincent to really work for me. And I think there's, like, if you just go to the culmination, the end of this movie in stark contrast to LA Takedown, like, the ending of this movie, like, vibrates, you know, for me. It's just, like, it's so perfect. But the way that it vibrates and that particular frequency that it hits is all because I'm so entangled with these people. And I think in, like, one, you know, in a previous episode with Joe Grabinski, who does the Amazon reviews on Twitter, a really great dude, he talks about, you know, just the in this big epic, if you just pick the characters and you pick their descriptors, you know, guy who's really bad at marriages because he's obsessed with his work and stuff like that, that there's the relatability of the people is what I think is the major difference. The challenge that I have with LA Takedown is I love parts of LA Takedown, but LA Takedown as a series would have frustrated the living daylights out of me because it basically does the thing that Tim Burton's Batman does, which is it kills the best villain at the end. You know what I mean? It's like the best villain of the whole series is gone. It's like you blow your wad on your Neil McCauley and it's like, who have you got left? No one, you know? So for me, whenever I think of like what LA Takedown could have done, or the aspiration is to like set up a, you know, an awesome 10 episode series with hour-ish long episodes throughout the whole thing, directed by Michael Mann, that sort of goes through the arc. The things that I'd want to do is look at everything that Heat does and then go, all right, I want to know more about Chris and Charlene, and I want to know more about Don Breeden, and I want to see more of his journey focus. I want to see more about Vincent's crew. I want to see more about Vincent's home life. Like, I want to see if they had a good time. I want to see if they had a bad time. I want to see the silhouette of Lauren's dad in a car the one time he turns up out of 10. You know, I want to see all this other stuff. So when I look at those moments, you know, and you sometimes see them, you mentioned Deadwood, like the way that Deadwood can ruminate on an event is like one of the most enviable things I think of any show ever is, you know, it can be just a, we've got to solve this problem. We've got a problem to solve, and it takes three or four whole beautifully, exquisitely written hour-long episodes, often from different perspectives of the town, before a culminating event or a culminating action happens, and then you sort of see how all these seemingly disparate threads all intertwine and entangle to get to what happens. And that's Deadwood. That's what makes it one of the greatest shows that's ever existed. And so when I look at that, I'm like, I don't think any of these different moments, despite, you know, I love my best friend Maria, she teases me frequently. She's like, I could pick a movie that you could, I don't need to even ask you. I could pick 10 movies that you'd want to marathon. All they have to be made is in the 90s. They have to be 45 minutes too long, and they have to have just 85% dudes. That's her exact words. And so I think the thing I love about Heat is that it feels fast and it feels percussive and it doesn't ever slow down for me when I watch it. And I think that's the tale of a really great long movie. It's like that it doesn't feel like for a second any moment of your time is being wasted. And so I think that that's what LA Takedown has it for it in spades, right? It's fast, it's well-paced. But I just, the thing that that infuriates me about LA Takedown to no end is that it blows its wad on two great villains. Like, I would almost love LA Takedown more if it just had the balls to have Vincent and Neil have a showdown and Wango get away and have a massive question mark, because then Vincent's got someone else to investigate.
Well, he does, doesn't he?
No.
Because he stops him right as he's there to get Wangro, and Vincent interrupts him, right?
Yeah, does it, unless I'm completely misremembering, but isn't it like Wangro gets Neil in a takedown, and then Vincent gets Wangro?
I want to say he's about to bust in the door on Wangro. Like, Wangro is not seen, but maybe I'm wrong.
To be honest, I haven't seen LA Takedown in a long while. I watched it once, and it was like watching, you know, the kids who made the shot-for-shot remake of the Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was like watching that, like in the nicest possible way. Like, the budget's way less. It's stripped back. It's sort of a proof of concept of what it might look like as a TV show. But for me, the speed with which that it operates, just nothing for me is the way that I would approach it. This more broader epic of, like, expansive, fully understanding all of these characters. You know, I think of the mounting weight of this movie coming down to that crescendo and the tense and the heightened state that you're in by the end. For me, the heightened state doesn't get there if you don't know all these people, if you don't have these stakes, and if you don't have the inherent tragedy of these moments. Because as you said, this all leads to a point where Vincent has a fatalistic outlook. You're right, Justine. All I am is what I'm going after. And now that you said I'm allowed to go, I'm going to dance down these stairs and I'm going to run off and I'm going to go to my fate. Like, that's what it is. And it's tragic. It doesn't get any happier. This is what's great. I'm having such a fun time talking to all the great people, such as yourself, on this show. And I just keep realizing that every mounting minute towards this ending has something that is emotionally devastating. Like, there's just no, it's an unrelenting slide. And I think all these bits help make that slide just, you know, it's all the more profound and powerful.
Well, it's funny you mention the thing about your criteria for, you know, your friend picking out best movies for you. I watched Heat with my oldest son recently for the first time. I've been kind of saving it. Like, I'm waiting till my kids can appreciate how good this is, you know. And of course you can't really until you've maybe watched it several times. And until you've seen a whole lot of shitty movies.
Yes.
It's hard to appreciate how good this one is. And there's, by the way, no doubt that I prefer Heat over LA Takedown.
Yeah, sorry.
But I got to say, when I watch LA Takedown, as a screenwriter, I kind of marvel at it.
Yes.
I'm like, oh man, this is really economical. Like, this really moves. I'm really impressed with it that way. But so I watched Heat with my son for the first time, And, you know, but today I picked him up from school and I said, hey, you know, I'm going to talk about Heat on the podcast. And I'm curious, you know, what were your impressions? What do you think about it? And pretty much what he said was, you know what I really liked about it? I really liked all the time it spent showing the wives and girlfriends and the effect this is all having on them. I mean, he brought up Don Breeden's, I don't know if it's his wife or girlfriend, but,
yeah, Lillian,
you know,
yeah.
watching the news in the bar and seeing him, you know, and he said, that really stuck with me. And seeing, you know, that Hannah's wife leaves him and this all, you know, it just, he was like, I really liked that. I really liked that they all, you know, there were all these little parallels between them. And, you know, the one thing that kind of brings, you know, all the guys in this movie together is them failing their women.
Like, pretty
wow,
universally.
Well, that was not, yeah. And I said that, you know,
that's a very astute, that's a very astute that, observation from a young,
yeah.
young man. Like he sounds like he is a very, very savvy little lad. That's awesome.
Yeah, definitely more so than I was.
Yeah. And that's the measure I'm saying. For me, I was like, oh, no, the bank heist, bro. You know, it was awesome.
Right.
Your son's there talking about the emotional impacts and the trajectory and looking behind the curtains of what consequences are. Like, he sounds like he's awesome.
So, yeah. Well, he is.
That's
I can't
great.
Take too much credit for that, but he's pretty great.
That's so cool. Man, he's going to love this movie when he's our age.
Yeah, I think
he's
so.
Gonna
and,
love the,
you know, I mean,
he's going to love the living daylights out of this
hopefully
movie.
Hopefully he looks back at this time in his life and it brings back good memories instead of, you know, other, you know, tied to other weird teenager stuff. But, yeah, I'm really excited to talk about it more in the future when he's seen it more often.
Yeah, that's the dream. Looking forward. I mean, I'm looking forward to showing both my kids Heat at one stage. I don't know when that is ever going to be. I don't know when it's ever going to be. I haven't really thought too hard about it because they're so little. But I just imagine that like one day there might be a Heat poster on the office wall, on the studio wall, and
absolutely.
What's that? Oh, that's Daddy's favorite movie. That's Daddy's favorite movie. Oh, why is that
it's
your
favorite?
It's
funny, I showed him.
Why is that your favorite? Well, here's 100 and here's a few episodes.
Here's 170 hours of it.
The abridged version is that I think it's a masterpiece. If you want the extended version, Daddy will send you a link. And you can listen on your microchip because by then we won't even have phones. It'll just be a microchip in our head. And go back and see if the archived internet, you can find it.
Yeah. Yeah. So one more question for you then. Listening to all these episodes, you know, sometimes other Michael Mann movies get mentioned. Mm. And we talk about how he reuses the same scenes and dialogue and character archetypes and themes a lot, which I think is great. But I want to know, I don't think I've heard you say you really don't like any of his films. LA Takedown, maybe just now, that was as close as I've
No,
I've
look,
heard.
I really...
Are,
I,
you, are there any of his films that you don't like?
Yes, yeah. I don't like Black Hat. I'm not a fan. I'm fundamentally not a fan of Black Hat. And what? But it's weird. Like, I'm always more about Jedediah, and I think you're a bit the same. It's like I'm way more for an ambitious failure than I am for something that is playing it exceptionally safe. So I respect Black Hat's aspiration of what it's trying to do, but it does not jive with me whatsoever. And I've tried to watch it, and this is the thing, I suppose, the difference between Michael Mann movie and a not Michael Mann movie is that I gave it more than one chance. Like, there are plenty of films I've watched once and gone, nope, I'm done. And people are like, no, watch it again, it's great. And I'm like, no, I have so many other things in the world that I could be doing, and I'm not, books to read, films to see, TV, great TV shows. Okay, I'm just not watching it. It's not happening. I think that that's what it is. But yeah, I'm not a fan of Black Hat. I'm not a fan of The Keep, where some people are like, it's fascinating, but it's, I just don't really like it. But I really do like, I think that's, you know, why he's my favorite filmmaker. I think for pound, I love a lot of his stuff. And I actually like, you know, even something that's more universally loved, like Collateral. I really like Collateral, but I don't love Collateral. It's not my favorite.
That's the one for me. That's the one I really don't like.
Yeah.
Really bothers me.
I'm not as huge a fan. I think it's one of Tom Cruise's best performances, but a lot of people rave about Collateral and say, Michael Mann's, you know, best movie is Collateral. And I'm like, I don't know what Michael Mann you've been watching, but the one I'm watching, you know, I've it's taken me a significant amount of time, and you know, people like Niall Schwartz is wonderful off the map book and more discussions to really relish Public Enemies. But at the time I wasn't completely jived on it, but like, I think Miami Vice is a masterpiece. Ali was a highway robbery for Will Smith. Like, if I was Will Smith and I was wanting like prestige, like how he didn't get an Oscar for that performance is just outlandish. I just don't understand, because he's absolutely incredible in it. That's a movie I've rewatched and just gone, God, this is good. Like, all across the park. Yeah. Mohicans is so fun. Mohicans is like just wonderful. Sunday matinee. Every 3 p.m. on a Sunday, there's like one movie I want to watch, and it's a James Bond movie or it's Last of the Mohicans. Like, that's it. Like, Sundays, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, I don't know. And, you know, contemporary environment we're in right now, you know, and as we're recording this, Julian Assange has just been dragged out of like an embassy and arrested. I'm like, remember when whistleblowers were doing a noble thing, like in The Insider? And now whistleblowers get dragged out of government institutions. Yes, I know he's a problematic individual, blah, 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 blah. Yes, yes. Okay, we can all agree on that. But just, you know, compare the whistleblower in when the whistleblower is the good guy and the big, you know, corporate military industrial complex and government were the bad guys in, you know, like New Hollywood and The Insider. And then remember what happens after that. You know, it's just... Anyway, but yeah, so no, yeah, definitely not as massive a fan of Collateral as everyone else. Definitely don't like Black Hat. Definitely not a fan of The Keep. But I've given them more chances than others.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I came around on Black Hat. First time I saw it, it really drove me nuts. But second time I saw it, I thought, I don't know, it's not so bad. And the third time I saw it, I think it was like, no, I think I really like this. And I've tried to do that with Collateral. I watch it probably once a year, and I keep timing, like, okay, when is it that I just tune out? When do I give up? And it's
is it for Jason Statham? Is it
what's that?
Is it when you see Jason Statham? Because that would be 30 seconds into the movie.
Hey, Jason Statham never heard a movie, in my opinion. But
he doesn't.
There's things about Collateral that I think are great, and I'm sure if somebody else had made that movie, it wouldn't bother me so much. But the fact that Michael Mann takes many years in between projects, and you know, and the things that I love about his work, I feel are not very well represented in Collateral. That's what makes, you know, really frustrates me. But I watch it frequently. You know, for a movie I don't like, I sure watch it an awful lot. I keep waiting for it to.
And that's the allure, right? It's like even a bad Michael Mann movie is more interesting than many people's, you know, good to middle to decent movies. You know, you're just a little bit more fascinated. You get something a little bit more out of it. And I've watched Black Hat again, and I probably will again. Even though I'm not a fan, because I'll talk to people like you, or I'll talk to people like Bill Gabbieri, amazing guest of the show, who's like the biggest Black Hat apologist in the world. I call them apologists, but he'll probably just say fanatic. He really loves Black Hat, and you know, there's at least there's something narratively interesting about sort of stripping away you know, stripping away that detail and making things very, you know, it's sort of elemental and taking away plot, you know. I think that's one of the things that makes something like Black Hat continue to be interesting, because it just is so, you know, you talk about marveling at LA Takedown. That's a marvel because it jams a lot of plot in and is super economical. And Black Hat, conversely, is like it has this sort of epic, you know, international swashbuckling hunt for a bad guy.
Right.
But it's the plot is so threadbare. Like, it just strips things away, takes things out, and then it has these little bursts of plot when it needs to pause for a breath, and then it's back to strip down, you know, just everything is action, action, action.
Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, Heat is probably, if you discount Takedown, Heat is probably most similar to Thief in his body of work. You watch Heat and you watch Thief and you go, yeah, there's a lot of overlap there. I think Black Hat and Manhunter actually are very similar in a lot of their
Don't
stuff.
You make me do it, Jedediah. I'm going to have to watch Black Hat again, and I'm going to have to do it in a double feature with Manhunter.
I think you
God damn it.
You know, just pretend Hemsworth isn't doing the accent or whatever the hell he's doing.
God, he's such a charming...
You know, maybe mute it.
He's such a charming bugger when he's not doing accents. I wish him more movies where he gets his Australian accent because he's funny.
Did he have to be American?
I wish for that. It's like Eric Banner. You know, I mean, Eric Banner as Chopper. And the only other movie that I think he's transcendent in, actually, and he does have an accent in this, is Munich. But Eric Banner in Chopper, he's a complete and utter psychopath, but he's so charming. He's so goddamn charming. It's like amazing. It's like, please, more movies with Eric Banner being an Aussie. And it was in that, what was the Apatow one? Funny People? You know, that silly small moment that he's in there as a crazy AFL supporting Australian is like perfect. That's the right amount of charm, the perfect dude you want to see in an Apatow movie, you know, as a bit player. But, oh, man, I don't know how we got here. Look, Jedediah, mate, I just want to say thank you so much for being a part of the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for your encouragement offline. And thank you so much for leading me towards other amazing folk that should be on the show. I'm deeply grateful and mindful that this is the last time we're going to talk during this project, but most certainly not the last time that we're going to talk and interact over the coming weeks, months. And I just want to say, because we're now, as we're recording, you guys are going to be listening to this in April, and we're recording this in April too, so we're all in that downhill slope towards July when the show ends. But I just want to say a huge thank you, mate, for all your support and everything you've done for this show and One Heat Minute and being a part of it.
Well, thanks so much. I've really enjoyed being on here, and thank you for doing 170 episodes so I don't have to.
and on that note, Jedediah can totally pick up the next Michael Mann podcast by minute show, if you like, at Jedediah Ayres, Jedidiah Ayres. You can find all of his stuff there. It's best to go straight through Twitter and his blog, SpaceyThompson on .blogspot.com. You can find that there. Peckerwood, I can highly recommend. And as we said, if you're in a secondhand thrift store in Oz, Fierce Bitches is somewhere to be found. Thank you, Mr. Garth Franklin, for our web design, Mr. Paul Davies for our music, and we'll catch you on another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner.
See ya.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.